Our guest today is Jefferson Morley, an author and a veteran journalist. He's worked in Washington, D.C. for over 30 years, 15 of which were spent as an editor and reporter at the Washington Post. His investigative writings about politics and the intelligence community have appeared in Salon, Slate, Counterpunch, The Intercept, and The Nation. Mr. Morley edits the well-regarded website jfkfacts.org and is regarded as one of the world's most credible authorities on the assassination of President Kennedy. For years, he has tirelessly advocated for the release of still-hidden records related to the assassination. Pursuant to that, he has actually sued the Central Intelligence Agency, seeking their compliance with the JFK Records Act of 1992. That act of Congress called for the release of all such records, yet to this day, many documents remain sequestered. Jefferson Morley has written three books about three men central to the JFK case. Our Man in Mexico was about Wynne Scott, the head of the CIA's Mexico City station. The Ghost was about James Angleton, the agency's counterintelligence chief. And Scorpion's Dance was about Richard Helms, former director of the CIA. We've been privileged to speak with the author about all three works and recommend them highly. We hope to be updated on tales of these men, as well as recent developments in the case, in future installments of this show. Today, however, we examine a fourth book written by our author, one dealing with a much earlier episode of political history. In 2012, Jefferson Morley wrote Snowstorm in August, The Struggle for American Freedom and Washington's Race Riot of 1835. The Wall Street Journal called the book a vibrant and illuminating picture of the antebellum capital when national stability depended upon placating the owners of slaves. Vibrant and illuminating it is, and to discuss the work, we're pleased to be able to say welcome back to Radio Parallax, Jefferson Morley.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I think most of our listeners are no doubt aware that there was a debate over slavery dividing this nation from its founding, but it's surely going to surprise listeners to learn that chained slaves were being sold in our nation's capital as late as the 1830s.
The Snowstorm in August tells a story that's not really very well known, which is about the coming of the Civil War, when anti-slavery politics enters and becomes a life and death issue in American politics. And that didn't happen at the time of the Revolution, and it didn't start in 1860. It actually started in the 1830s. And that's the story I tell in Snowstorm.
Yes, indeed. You start the book with a tale about a rather talented Virginia slave. He bought his freedom, then moved to Washington. But it's pretty clear that a freed person of color was, at that point, a pretty dicey proposition.
When I started writing this book, Doug, one of the things that really interested me was I was looking at the 1830 census for Washington City. And Washington was a town of about 30,000 people then. And of those 30,000, 12,000 were African American. But what interested me was, out of the 12,000 African Americans in Washington, slightly more than half, 6,000, were actually free people of color and were not enslaved. And so I was startled by that fact, that 30 years before the Civil War, half the black people in Washington were free. I mean, if you think about that, what it tells you is, in the nation's capital, slavery as a practice was actually receding long before the Civil War, and free black people were replacing enslaved black people in the life of the capital. And it was precisely that free population, the population of free people of color, that creates the civil unrest in 1835 that I write about in Snowstorm in August, where white mobs come for the free people of color, the white abolitionists, seeking to intimidate them and drive them out of the Capitol and drive their message out of Washington.
A popular solution to slavery at that time, which you spent some time on, was this idea that slaves would just be returned to Africa. The abolitionists then were fighting against that and saying we should have freedom here in America, and for that they sometimes were getting beaten up.
Yes, in the 1820s and 1830s, the respectable, high society solution to slavery was that all the free black people would go back to Africa and only enslaved Africans would remain in America. And people like Francis Scott Key, who is the district attorney of Washington and the famous author of The Star-Spangled Banner, this was what he advocated. And likewise, the young Abraham Lincoln is elected to public office for the first time in 1836. He's an advocate of colonization, as it was called. So sending the black people back to Africa. And the abolition movement, yes, like you said, rose up in opposition to slavery, but also in opposition to colonization, especially in Washington. The free people of color said, no, we don't want to go back to Washington. We don't want to go back to Africa. We've never been there. This is our country. And it was that emergence of a more radical anti-slavery movement that rejected colonization and demanded immediate abolition of the system of bondage that this the conflict over slavery really starts coming to a head, but emerges in Washington as a political debate, really for the first time in the 1830s. Before that, slavery was not a national political issue.
Well, your book fleshes out quite ably the story of Francis Scott Key and his brother-in-law, Roger Taney, who would gain quite a bit of influence in the future. We think of the red versus blue dynamics to dominate our today's politics as going to the Civil War, but you show in Snowstorm in August that this divide was forming during the Jackson administration.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the way the slavery debate takes place in Congress, starting in the 1830s, it pits northern and midwestern states, Ohio, Massachusetts, against the South and the West, the old Confederacy, or what would become the Confederacy, and also the Western Territory of Texas. So that kind of red-blue divide is very similar 180 years ago to what it is today.
Well, the author of the Star-Spangled Banner becomes the DA in Washington, D.C. He assists the political advancement of his brother-in-law, fellow attorney Roger Taney. And I was quite struck in your book reading about how Roger Taney was early on doing his best to curtail the rights of black people and declaring when he was Attorney General of the United States that, quote, the privileges they are allowed to enjoy are accorded as a matter of kindness and benevolence rather than a right. And that continued right on to his going on to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so Roger Taney was a lawyer in Maryland, like Francis Scott Key, and he was married to the sister of Key's wife, Polly, and these two men became fast friends. Taney was attorney general for the state of Maryland, and then Jackson liked him and took him on as attorney general in his cabinet, and then liked him so much that he appointed him Treasury Secretary so that Taney could carry on his Jackson's war on U.S. Bank, the biggest bank in the country at the time, whose power Jackson wanted to break. He regarded that as the power of the Eastern establishment. But Taney, like you said, was gunning for, was pro-slavery long before he got to the Supreme Court, 25 years before he wrote the Dred Scott decision. When he was Attorney General, he issued a statement about black sailors who were free and who sailed on ships up and down the Atlantic. Were they free when they got into their home ports? And in 1832, Taney writes a ruling in which you can even hear the echoes of the language that he'll use in the Dred Scott decision about, we are under no obligation to affect the rights of these free people of color. So Taney had been planning that for a long time, and it's in the second term of Andrew Jackson that Taney rises to power, first going from Attorney General to Treasury Secretary, and then in 1836, with the help of Francis Scott Key, he is nominated and approved as Chief Justice of the United States, and that's a position that he would hold until the Civil War.
Well, back in the 1830s, there were racial tensions in the Capitol being stoked by some slave rebellions taking place in the country. And at one point, a young, rather ne'er-do-well slave frightens his whole household by drunkenly wielding an axe. And from there, matters explode out of control. Can you tell us how that evolved?
Yeah, Arthur Bowen was the property of a woman named Anna Thornton. She was a very prominent woman in Washington society. He had been promised his freedom by her husband, who had died subsequently, and she reneged on the promised to free him. And so he was very angry about that and got drunk one night and stumbled into her room and threatened her. His mother, who was also the property of Mrs. Thornton, shooed him out of the room, but the neighborhood was awakened and everybody, you know, made this a big deal. Arthur disappeared. There was a manhunt for him. And when he was captured, a white mob forms to lynch him. He's taken to the jail in Judiciary Square in Washington, and a mob of several thousand men converge on the jail because they're convinced this is the beginning of a slave uprising. Key, as district attorney, calls in the Secretary of the Navy, and he sends a contingent of Marines down from the Navy Yard on Capitol Hill, and they surround the jail, and they protect Arthur Bowen from the mob. So see in this is a kind of complete breakdown of civil order in Washington over the slavery issue. And Key, as the district attorney, is really loses control of the city as the white mob rampages for a few days.
Well, in the midst of all this, someone accused the restaurant operator, who you start the book with, Beverly Snow, of using some disrespectful language about what were called the mechanics, who were the rioters. The mob then destroys his restaurant. Snow is lucky to escape with his life, although, of course, there's no proof he ever made any provocative statements.
What happened was when the mob couldn't get to Arthur Bowen, they turned on all the prominent free people of color in the city. And so Beverly Snow, as the owner of the restaurant, was very successful and respected, even in white society. So he was attacked. John Cook was a preacher, a free man of color who ran a school at 14th and New York Avenue. His school was attacked and trashed. So any of the free people of color, especially those who had property and homes and standing, they were the targets of the mob. So that was part of the point, was to try and drive these people out and eliminate any signs of black freedom or manumission or success among the people of color, and wipe out any anti-slavery politics as well.
Well, this 1835 riot, I think, did turn the citizenry against mobocracy, which you talk about. And I have to ask at this point, Jeff, what you thought in 2021 when you saw rioters roving the Capitol in a similar fashion to what you'd written about a decade earlier.
Well, you know, it just over the years, since I wrote the book in 2012, just come to see how formative these events were. And one thing that I really picked up and is not taught really in the history, not taught in the history I learned in high school and college, was about this white violence. And Washington had a white riot in 1835. Washington had another white riot in 1919, on the same streets where 85 years earlier the white mob had, you know, chased Beverly Snow and trashed the schools and the churches. White mobs attacked black people up along 7th Street and up along U Street in the heart of the black neighborhoods in Washington. And, you know, these eruptions of violence occurred at times of white backlash against black aspirations for political equality, against black success, both in 1835 and in 1919. And, you know, when we saw the January 6th riot, it was very much a similar kind of, you know, breakdown of civil disorder, a white backlash against, you know, the election of the man who had been the vice president for the first black president and the first black vice president coming into office. You know, so it was, to me, it was a sign of how deeply this is kind of etched in our national history and, you know, has recurred over the centuries for a reason.
Well, Jeff, I confess I bought Snowstorm in August some years back, but never got around to reading it till recently. And when I did, I was just stunned with how history is repeating itself in a way. There's a shocker in your book where you quote one editor back at the time writing that he saw the problem was that Andrew Jackson appealed to the common man and his supporters had a hostility traditionally to the elites, saying at that time, in pursuit of a majority to sustain their power, they have classified the rich and intelligent and denounced them as aristocrats, which I mean, is this 1835 or now?
No, it's very much the same. You see these echoes in a lot of different ways. There was a guy, I mentioned him a few times in the book. He's not really a major character, but he was a very interesting man, Arthur Tappan. And Arthur Tappan was the exact analog to George Soros today. Arthur Tappan was a very wealthy guy. He was a natural businessman. Everything he touched, he made very successful. And he traded with China, and he opened the first country's first financial newspaper. And he had four brothers. And so they were like this team, and they were like this very successful, almost hedge fund. And they were super radical progressive, besides being very wealthy. And they, so Tappan funded the anti-slavery movement all throughout the United States. Furious denunciations of him. You know, he was a villain in the same way that George Soros is a villain. He was the money bags who was funding this treachery that was, you know, ruining the country with foreign ideas, and how dare he, and if he comes here, we'll kill him. And it's like, and you see this kind of invective over the years in the Southern newspapers, and it's like, it's the same story that is published today about George Soros. It's the exact same story. So the clothes are different. The styles are different. You know, the technology is different. But you see the fundamental conflicts that, you know, pervades American society. They're not that different.
Well, my God, Jeff, there were many studies, the 2021 rioters. They said these are people who hold to the belief that really the unifying factor was that they saw people of color as rising up and gaining on whites. And to me, this is like your Beverly Snow story all over again. A black man with more money and prestige than the average white man, igniting resentments then and now.
It's very true. You know, my other books are about the CIA and contemporary times and, you know, a lot of sinister white men and machinations at the high level. But Snowstorm in August is my favorite book in some ways because it has the widest range of humanity. I mean, it has the villains like Roger Taney and the heroes like Beverly Snow. And then people in between like Francis Scott Key, like, is he a horrible hypocrite? Is he a pathetic loser? You know, like, I could never quite figure that out. But a wide range of humanity in the Snowstorm story, which is why I really like that book.
It's a great book. We can't recommend it highly enough to listeners. We hope they'll go pick it up and take a look at it. In the case of Arthur Bowen, the man who was started the riot by drunkenly wielding an axe or brandishing an axe, his owner, Anna Thornton, pled with President Jackson directly to pardon the boy. And we should note, he had been convicted of attempted murder by virtue of the DA, Francis Scott Key, omitting exculpatory testimony. But Jackson did grant her wish.
Yeah, when Arthur comes to trial a few months later, Mrs. Thornton actually comes to his defense. And so this was the shocking incident that set off the, you know, that set off the riot. And the stories were that the young slave boy had attacked, you know, come into a room with a raised axe. And when he put her on the stand, she said, no, that's not what happened at all. She said he stumbled into the room. He stared around. He was so drunk he couldn't do anything. And we screamed and we shooed him out of the room. And she said he never raised the axe. He was acting threateningly, but she said he wasn't trying to kill me. Well, that created a big problem for Keith because he's trying to get he's trying to get a conviction so that he can prove, you know, that he's tough on crime, to use the modern, that he would enforce the slave laws and he would execute this young man for attempting to kill his owner. And so Mrs. Thornton, you know, creates this big problem for him. Well, he had a biased jury and he got the conviction anyway. But then Mrs. Thornton didn't stop. Like I said, she was a woman of means. She was in high society. Her husband, William, was the man who had designed the U.S. Capitol. So she could go see President Jackson. You know, she was in society. And she goes to Jackson and she pleads for the boy's life and says, look, he didn't mean to kill me. And if you execute him, that will be worse than the crime itself. And when I was doing the book, George Lardner, another reporter at the Post, was writing a book about presidential pardons. And I mentioned this, and he said, oh, well, you should go out and look at the pardon file. Everybody who's ever applied for a presidential pardon, the National Archives has a record of that. So I went out there, and I pulled up the Jackson pardon file, and sure enough, I find Mrs. Thornton's letter in there, 17 pages, where she explained what happened that night and pleads with Jackson, please save his life, please save his life. And Jackson finally acceded, finally agreed to do that.
Well, it fascinates me that Jackson, after he was prevailed upon and was convinced, well, maybe I should grant some clemency here, he asked for legal advice on how he could do that. Could he modify Bowen's sentence? And apparently was told he could not, but he could pardon a convicted man. And that issue of presidential pardons is something else I don't imagine you thought would still be reverberating today.
Yeah. What is the nature of the presidential pardon? And what Jackson wanted was, Jackson basically wanted to commute his sentence to a life sentence because he wanted to be seen as being, you know, tough on enforcing rebellious behavior among enslaved people, but he wanted to extend the mercy that Mrs. Thornton was asking for. But the lawyers came back and said, no, the pardon power is absolute. You can't modify a sentence. You can only, you know, eliminate it, a conviction. And so Jackson decided to pardon him and then insisted that he be sold away. And so that's what happened. But Arthur Bowen lived to see another day.
District Attorney Key apparently does go after some of those rioters, and the leaders were given prison sentences by a judge who remembered the British Rampage back in 1814. You quoted him as saying, once a mob is raised, all who assisted in raising it are guilty of all consequences. And when I read that, Jeff, I wish that guy was still on the bench.
It was so true. Yeah, so when he was confronted with the white rioters, he brought the ringleaders of the riot, the guys who were egging the crowd on the most and leading in the destruction. There were six guys, and he brings them to trial. And then after making the case against them, he says to the judge, I'm not going to ask for a sentence because we're just going to throw them at the mercy of the court. And what Key was expecting was that the judge would say, you know, these men had reason to be outraged by Beverly Snow, and so therefore, you know, they should be treated leniently. But the judge had exactly the opposite reaction, and he stunned Key and the defendant by throwing the book at them, giving them the maximum sentence, 6 months in the penitentiary, and giving them this lecture about the dangers of a mob. So, yeah, Judge William Cranch, he was the kind of judge we need today.
Well, there's some ironies in the follow-up to all of this. Restaurateur Beverly Snow almost gets killed when he returns to Washington after the riots, but the mayor manages to stop that. He does require that Snow leave town, and he gladly does so. Snow goes north to Canada, again becomes a success. The irony here, I think, is the British Parliament banned slavery in all its colonies in 1832 is something we could only manage through civil war.
Yeah, after escaping the mob, Snow comes back to town, pays off his debts, and clears out and decides to go to Toronto. You know, he could go north, but there was still danger of being kidnapped by, you know, bounty hunters, slave traders. So he went to Canada, which had abolished slavery in 1833 and had become a mecca for free people of color fleeing the United States because it was very close. And so he goes to Toronto and he opens up another restaurant there that burns down. He opens up a bar, and he winds up being a very successful caterer and running a catering business for the courts of Canada, and died a rich man in 1857, although still to the end involved in anti-slavery politics. In 1857, right before Snow died, John Brown came to Toronto and said that he was making plans to raise up an anti-slavery army. And, you know, did people want to join him? And so the Black abolitionists of Toronto had a meeting to consider this. A couple of people signed up with Brown, not Beverly Snow. But so he was active in anti-slavery politics for the rest of his life.
Well, Jeff, I appreciate the vivid tales that you brought forth in this book. I encourage you to another deep dive into history just like it in the future. One detail I just have to throw out, which just, you know, it just rounded out the picture in a lot of things, was that you explain how when Beverly Snow first sets up a successful restaurant in D.C., I never realized what a novelty that was at the time. I mean, this is something that was that we didn't have in America. We didn't have restaurants in the way we think of them today, and he really got the ball rolling on that.
Yeah, you know, if you were eating in public in the 1820s, like you're staying at a hotel if you're traveling, a hotel and a tavern were really the same thing. But there would be one meal a day served. There'd be a big pot, it would be put out on the table, and you served yourself and you sat down and you ate. And so what, starting in the late 18th century in France, people started creating a menu where instead of just there being one thing, you could have a choice of things and you could order and have your meal made specifically. Also, it began to have private tables. So you just had a table for you and your friends. All of these things had never been done before. And in a way, the restaurant was kind of a democratic institution in the sense that you could have this fine dining experience of a rich household, you know, even if you didn't have a big house, you know, but you could have that for one night. And so Snow picked up on this model of the restaurant, and the Epicurean Eating House, which was his restaurant at 6th in Pennsylvania, was the first such eating place in Washington, where you had private seating, you had your own menu, you had your own choice of food, and it was an immediate social success. You can tell from the advertisements that Snow put in the paper, his business did very well because this was something people really liked. It was a way to be seen in public, but also, you know, have a private experience. And it was part and parcel of Washington growing from really like a southern village into something more like a city, with Pennsylvania Avenue, with stores, bars, hotels, restaurants. The modern capital is beginning to take shape even in the 1830s. So who ate at Beverly Snow's restaurant? Same people who eat at Washington restaurants today. Lawyers, lobbyists, politicians, tourists, you know. That was all happening in the 1830s on a much smaller scale, of course, but the same kind of life of the capital that we have today. So I would say, you know, there's thousands of restaurants in Washington, D.C. today, but it all started in one place, and that was Beverly Snow's restaurant. So that's, to me, that's like an amazing thing right there.
The book is Snowstorm in August, The Struggle for American Freedom and Washington's Race Riot of 1836. We've been speaking with author Jefferson Morley. Your current work on JFK-related matters is something we should mention. And please take the time to refer people to the podcast you're doing and where they can learn more.
We've been talking about Washington in the 19th century, but if you're interested in my work on JFK's assassination in the 1960s, check out my Substack, JFK Facts, which is on Substack, jfkfacts.substack.com, where we do original reporting on the JFK story, on new documents that are coming out, new people that have come forward with new accounts or new analysis. It's the most authoritative source on the internet. I think I feel very safe to say that.
Well, we can't recommend it highly enough to listeners, and I hope that you can come back soon and talk about the latest developments.
I can do that, yeah.
Jefferson Morley, thanks again. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Doug.
This program was produced by Edward McMillan. Thanks also to Guy Tortorisi, who's manning the booth at 90.3 FM. Thanks, Guy. I'm your host, Douglas Everett. We'll see you again real soon.